Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the March 14th, 2022 Monday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Dee Hyslop. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Businesses, Workers Trying to Find Balance by Megan Ululani Boyanton. Russian Strike Kills 35 at Base by Yuris Karmanow of the Associated Press. Population of Black People Up in Suburbs, Down in Cities by Sophia Tureen of the AP, and following up with miscellaneous articles. Businesses, workers trying to find balance. Many Colorado employees prefer hybrid or remote schedules by Megan Ululani Boyanton. Metro area companies are preparing to welcome an influx of employees back to their offices as COVID-19 cases dwindle statewide, but it's still too early to define the business sector's new normal. Industry giants including Bank of America, Google, Centura Health, and Lockheed Martin are experimenting with different approaches to reestablish their office cultures. But many Colorado workers are insisting on staying flexible with hybrid schedules and remote cultures to remain their work-life balances. It's a delicate dance between employers and employees as new standards for businesses are negotiated. I truly hope I never am required to go back into the office again, said Wendy Homstead, who lives in Hudson and works in Denver's healthcare industry. I love no longer having the commute and how much more time I have available. However, she admits to losing social skills, adding that she also doesn't listen to as many podcasts now that I have less time in the car. CBRE, a global commercial real estate agency with several offices in Colorado, said it's too soon to make a definitive statement about companies returning to their downtown Denver office spaces, as there isn't conclusive data quite yet. However, leasing activity in Metro Denver spiked 39 points in January, standing 17% above the pre-pandemic baseline, according to CBRE's monthly Pulse of U.S. Office Demand report. The corona pandemic forced businesses away from traditional in-person work settings where the risk of COVID-19 outbreaks loomed. Instead, companies with the capacity to work remotely embraced it, with employees eventually settling into its perks. No commuting costs, weekday traffic, or uncomfortable office clothes, on top of more time allotted for loved ones, errands, and travel. Bank of America, which operates more than 15 financial centers and ATMs in the Denver area, is one business that's started a gradual shift back to the office, said Senior Vice President Louise Hennessy in an emailed statement. She expects the majority of their employees to have returned during March. The company doesn't require COVID-19 vaccines, but it recently launched an initiative to encourage booster shots by donating $100 to local food banks for every U.S. employee who either informed the bank of their booster status or received one by the end of February, Hennessy said. The effort amassed a $10 million donation, with $125,000 raised locally and given to Food Bank of the Rockies, she said. Although some are ready to socialize by the communal coffee pot, many employees are grumbling about their bosses' attempts to gather in offices once more. Attitudes can span generations, as 62% of baby boomer remote workers consider remote work extremely desirable, according to survey data by Apartment List, published on March 8th. Meanwhile, only 36% of Generation Z remote employees feel the same way. Better stay at home, said Emmanuel Rosaka, an IT analyst in Denver. Everything is high in prices, yet jobs are not increasing salaries. Not only is he saving gas in his car and time spent commuting, but Rusaka is also enjoying more moments with his wife and family. I'd rather be home, he added. The cost of regular gas, exacerbated by the Russia-Ukraine conflict recently hit a national average of $4.43 per gallon, the Associated Press reported Sunday. In Colorado, commuters have to shell out an average of $3.97. That's not far off from the state's highest recorded average price, $4.09 in July 2008 during the Great Recession. Inflation is also squeezing wallets nationwide, with a boost in auto insurance rates expected this year, said Rod Griffin, Senior Director of Consumer Education and Advocacy for Experian. With commuting costs high and requirements to work in person, companies may see more of their talent leave and have a more difficult time recruiting, said Andrew Challenger, Senior Vice President at firm Challenger, Gray & Christmas, Inc. 82% of 150 U.S. employers surveyed by his firm in January and February reported that they're worried about an exodus of talent. Still, several of the state's major employers are in the process of gathering their employees face-to-face. Google's Boulder offices are set to begin their new hybrid work model on April 4th, with most employees working in person about 3 days a week and 2 days wherever they choose, said spokesperson Hannah Hunt. We also know that Googlers value having more options for where and how they work, and they'll be able to explore flexible work options, including work-from-anywhere weeks, location transfers, or fully remote work, she added in an email statement. Employees who need more time before returning can also request a work-from-home extension. Lockheed Martin, which manages several locations in the Denver area, anticipates that about 50% of its employees will work on-site, with some 40% continuing to maintain flexibility in where they work, and about 10% working full-time from a non-company site or virtually, said spokesperson Dana Casey. The aerospace company implemented a flexible teleworking policy during the pandemic for employees who can fulfill their roles remotely, and a significant portion of its workforce is currently teleworking or has a hybrid schedule based on their positions, Casey added. Centura Health, a healthcare system serving Colorado and western Kansas, has provided remote work options for its non-clinical associates, while welcoming up to 50% of them back to the office for more than a year, said Sebastian Girard, Senior Vice President and Chief People Officer. We are developing a long-term remote work policy for non-clinical associates that we plan to debut in July so as not to interrupt school year routines for our families, he said in an emailed statement. This policy will recognize the need for some roles to be office-focused while others are more focused on remote work. Governor Jared Polis's office and other state agencies have worked in person in a hybrid capacity since the COVID-19 vaccine became available to the public, said spokesperson Melissa Dworkin. Polis signed an executive order on February 16th to enhance employee work-life flexibility, allowing the state to standardize flexible work practices, Dworkin added in an emailed statement. The order also authorized the Colorado Department of Personnel and Administration to create a new space plan that reduces all state office space by at least 30% or 1 million square feet from pre-pandemic levels, whichever is greater. Researchers at Ladders, a career site project, project that 25% of all high-paying professional jobs in North America will be remote by the end of the year, with even more opportunities available next year. Eric Elkins, owner and CEO of WideFocus.us Social Media, is one Denverite whose business will allow that trend. I don't think we'll ever go back to an office environment, he said. He shuttered his office in Lohi because of the pandemic and eventually gave up the search for a larger space. His team instead dedicated themselves to building a remote culture that worked for them. We sent little gifts. We plied people with Grubhub cards for our now remote lunch and learns, and we spent a lot of time figuring out modes and methods of open, honest, and direct communication in lieu of the subtle nonverbal cues we could interpret when in an open office together, Elkins said, admitting that it took time to adjust. Now he describes remote work as life-changing, and not just because the company is saving on rent money and other expenses. As an empty nester, remote work has allowed me to be a bit of a digital nomad, doing the job from Todos Santos for a month or Maui for a few weeks, Elkins said. As long as I have strong Wi-Fi and an affordable place to stay, I can work from anywhere. Carol Armendariz, a PCB design engineer at Samtec Microelectronics in Colorado Springs, started working from home in March 2020 and envisions doing so for the foreseeable future. When her manager recently asked her preference of either returning to the office or staying remote, Armendariz asked to work from home indefinitely, and he obliged. She predicts the majority of her team will follow suit, pointing to one female colleague who moved from Indiana to Hawaii this past year, a relocation that her coworker always dreamed of doing. "It was a transition, but now I would not have it any other way," Armendariz said. Russian strike kills 35 at base. Attack in western Ukraine comes close to Polish border, by Yuris Karmanow of the AP. Russian missiles pounded a military base in western Ukraine on Sunday, killing 35 people in an attack on a facility that served as a crucial hub for cooperation between Ukraine and the NATO countries supporting its defense. The barrage marked an escalation of Moscow's offensive and moved the fighting perilously close to the Polish border. The attack so near a NATO member country raised the possibility that the alliance could be drawn into the fight and was heavy with symbolism in a conflict that has revived old Cold War rivalries and threatened to rewrite the current global security order. More than 30 Russian cruise missiles targeted the sprawling facility at Yavoriv, which has long been used to train Ukrainian soldiers, often with instructors from the United States and other countries in the Western alliance. Poland is also a transit route for Western military aid to Ukraine, and the strikes followed Moscow's threats to target those shipments. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called it a black day and again urged NATO leaders to establish a no-fly zone over the country, a plea that the West has said could escalate the war to a nuclear confrontation. "If you do not close our sky, it is only a matter of time before Russian missiles fall on your territory, NATO territory, on the homes of citizens of NATO countries," Zelensky said. In addition to the fatalities, the Ukrainian Defense Ministry said that 134 people were wounded in the attack. Ina Potty, a 40-year-old Ukrainian who crossed the border with her family, was taking shelter at a fire station in Wielki Aksi, Poland, when she was awakened by blast Sunday morning that made the glass in the windows shake. "I understood in that moment, even if we are free of it, the war, it's still coming after us," she said. "Since their invasion more than 2 weeks ago, Russian forces have struggled in their advance across Ukraine in the face of stiffer-than-expected resistance, bolstered by Western weapons support. Instead, Russian forces have besieged several cities and pummeled them with strikes, hitting 24 medical facilities and leading to a series of humanitarian crises. The UN has recorded at least 596 civilian deaths, though it believes the true toll is much higher, and Ukraine's prosecutor general's office said that at least 85 children are among them. Millions more people have fled their homes amid the largest land conflict in Europe since World War II. Talks for a broad ceasefire have so far failed, but the Kremlin's spokesman said another round would take place on Monday by video link, according to Russian state news agency TASS. Meanwhile, U.S. President Joe Biden is sending his national security advisor to Rome to meet with a Chinese official. There are worries in Washington that Beijing is amplifying Russian disinformation and may help Moscow evade punishing Western economic sanctions. Zelensky said he will continue negotiating with Russia and making requests for a meeting with Putin, which so far have gone unanswered by the Kremlin. "Our delegation has a clear task to do everything to ensure a meeting of the presidents," Zelensky said in a nightly address to the nation. Zelensky said daily talks between the two countries via video conference are necessary to establish a ceasefire and add more humanitarian corridors, which saved more than 130,000 people in 6 days. The attacked training base near Yavoriv is less than 15 miles from the Polish border and appears to be the westernmost target struck during Russia's 18-day invasion. The base has hosted NATO drills, and a senior official, Admiral Rob Bauer, previously hailed it as embodying the spirit of military cooperation between Ukraine and international forces. As such, the site is a potent symbol of Russia's long-standing concerns that the expansion in recent years of the 30-member Western military alliance to include former Soviet states threatens its security, something NATO denies. Still, the perceived threat from NATO is central to Moscow's justifications for the war, and it has demanded Ukraine drop its ambitions to join the alliance. Lviv Governor Maxim Kozitsky said most Russian missiles fired Sunday were shot down because the air defense system worked. Those that got through killed at least 35 people and wounded 134, he said. The United States condemned the attack on Yovariv, with Secretary of State Antony Blinken tweeting, "The brutality must stop." Russian fighters also fired at the airport in the western city of Ivano-Frankivsk, which is less than 94 miles north of Romania and 155 miles from Hungary, to other NATO allies. NATO said Sunday that it currently does not have any personnel in Ukraine, though the United States has increased the number of American troops deployed to Poland. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the West would respond if Russia's strikes travel outside Ukraine and hit any NATO members, even accidentally. NATO has said it will not send troops into Ukraine, but Sullivan said the U.S. and its allies have gotten substantial amounts of military assistance, weapons, and supplies to the front, and that despite Russian threats of attack, they believed they would be able to continue to do so. Ukrainian and European leaders have pushed with limited success for Russia to grant safe passage to civilians trapped by fighting. Ukrainian authorities said more than 10 humanitarian corridors would open Sunday with agreement from Russia, including from the besieged port city of Mariupol, where the city council said 2,187 people have been killed. But such promises have repeatedly crumbled. Zelensky reported Saturday that 1,300 Ukrainian soldiers had died in the war. The Russians said days ago that several hundred of their forces have died, but have not given a recent updated account. Population of black people up in suburbs, down in cities, by Sophia Turin of the AP. A longtime area staple with its wagon wheel decor in Roy Rogers' Ribeye, the ranch steakhouse is fighting to reopen as one of the last sit-down restaurants in the once flourishing black Chicago neighborhood of Roseland. About 13 miles away near Indiana, Christopher Kane and wife Deja Cousins Kane sought a new market for their wine bar that promises good vibes only, settling on the suburb of Lansing, where growth has included a steady increase in black residents. The two enclaves of roughly 30,000 people reflect how black migration patterns in the 21st century are changing the makeup of metropolitan areas nationwide. For decades, black residents have been leaving some of the nation's largest cities, while suburbs have seen an increase in their black populations. Those two trends have now spread to even more areas of the country, according to the 2020 U.S. Census. The patterns echo the white flight that upended urban landscapes in the 20th century. Like those who left cities before them, black residents often move because of worries about crime and a desire for reputable schools, affordable housing, and amenities. But there are key differences. Leaving black city neighborhoods that are starved for investment is often more of a necessity than a choice, and those who do settle into new suburban lives often find racial inequities there too. From 1990 to 2000, 13 of the United States' biggest cities lost black residents. By 2020, it was 23. According to the census, roughly 54% of black residents within the 100 biggest American metro areas were suburbanites in 2020, up from 43% 2 decades ago, according to Bill Frey of the Brookings Institution. While New York, Los Angeles, and Philadelphia all lost black residents from 2010 to 2020, the change was especially notable in Chicago, which gained population but lost 85,000 black people, the highest number after Detroit, according to the 2020 census. Those numbers could vary slightly, as the Census Bureau reported last week that 3.3% of the black population was undercounted in the 2020 census, a rate higher than in 2010. The official count found that a section of Roseland measuring less than 1 square mile lost 1,600 black residents. Now the area near where former President Barack Obama was a community organizer located about 20 miles south of downtown, doesn't even have a grocery store. That makes Judy Ware, who bought the ranch restaurant in 2018, more determined to hang on. "We take pride in trying to keep this institution in the neighborhood," she said. "It's needed." For others, though, the suburbs offer a fresh choice. Cousins Kane and her husband surprised themselves in choosing Lansing, which wasn't always friendly to black people. Settled by Dutch and German immigrants, the city has seen a roughly 50% increase in its black residents, who now represent almost half the population. Lansing recently elected its first black trustee. "It just feels like we are finally getting an opportunity to bring something to the table and bring something to the conversation," Cousins Kane said. The trends are nuanced. Part of the explanation is that black residents are continuing to move to southern cities in a reversal of the Great Migration, a movement that began in the 1910s and resulted in millions leaving the South for northern cities to escape discrimination. But more recently, some of the starkest changes are happening within metro areas as suburbs of major cities see black population growth. Black residents, who represented roughly 40% of Chicago's population in 1980, now make up less than 30%. Their presence increased, meanwhile, in dozens of Chicago suburbs from 2010 to 2020. Chicago residents and demographers offer no shortage of reasons for the urban exodus. The decline of the steel industry and blue-collar jobs starting in the 1970s, the war on drugs, the dismantling of public housing in the 2000s that displaced thousands of black residents, school closures in 2014 that disproportionately affected black and Latino children. "It's really hard to point to one specific thing," said Dan Cooper, director of research with Chicago's Metropolitan Planning Council. "And when you look at the confluence of factors, black folks haven't been centered in policy, or they are centered in wrong ways. Chicago, long a segregated city, continues to report disparate outcomes by race when it comes to home ownership, income, transportation access, and more. In Roseland, residents note persistent crime, delayed city services, and a train line that ends at Roseland's northern edge. Worries persist about population loss diluting black population political power, as drafts of a political remapping show fewer majority black wards. Many said those issues forced them to leave. Truck driver Chris Calhoun, 32, sought more peace in suburban South Holland in 2014. The deciding factor for him, he said, was, "Where can I live where my kids can go outside and ride their bikes, or we can take a walk around the block as a family without looking over my shoulder?" Crystal Fenn left in 2015 for law school in suburban Atlanta, where she's now an attorney. "If you could do anything better for yourself, why would you want to be there?" she said. "The lack of economic dollars, it's almost like the city doesn't care about Roseland anymore." Once a Dutch enclave, Roseland was annexed into Chicago in 1892. Within decades, there was an influx of black families. Mark Pullins, 56, recalls four nearby grocery stores and has found fond memories of Cone Elementary School. "Half the neighborhood went to that school," said Pullins, a current resident and activist. "They're all gone." Cone is located within the section of Roseland that lost more than 1,600 black residents. The school sits vacant, a green for sale sign out front. It is among the roughly 55 schools targeted by former Mayor Rahm Emanuel in the nation's largest mass school closure. Nearby homes and businesses, including a candy shop, are shuttered. The vacancies extend down a once thriving business corridor that Preservation Chicago has deemed among Chicago's most endangered places. Keisha Pleasant, 41, bought her first home in Roseland, but violence and dwindling amenities pushed her out. "I can't retire in this area," she said. "I want to come outside. I don't want to be scared that somebody will be shooting at me." Last year, she moved to Lansing. Samira and Gerald Miller moved with their daughter to a leafy Lansing street 6 years ago after living in Chicago and neighboring Oak Park. They bought a home near a top school for less than what they would have paid in Chicago. Lansing's median home price is about $195,000, less than half the city's median. "Lansing to this day still has kids outside in the summertime playing," Gerald Miller said. "You don't really get that in the city without worry." The growing black Population prompted Michaela Smith, who moved to Lansing in 2002 to seek office. She became the suburb's first Black trustee last year after a challenging campaign in the predominantly white suburb. "I had to do more persuasion to convince the voters," Smith said. Activists say Lansing has had its fair share of issues involving race. In 2017, a Black teenager was held down and threatened by a white off-duty police officer, a confrontation that led the city to enter a memorandum of understanding with activists and the U.S. Department of Justice. Pastor David Bigsby of In the Upper Room Ministries recently held a community call about disproportionate traffic stops, noting a major thoroughfare largely divides Black and white residents. "It's still segregated in town," he said. Still, the 76-year-old who moved into the parsonage 6 years ago has about 250 congregants now, an increase of about 20%. Lansing is also seeing a boost in Black-owned businesses. Kane and Cousins Kane opened their chic SL wine bar last year, with R&B and jazz setting the mood. Support, particularly from Black customers, has been strong. "We want our own version of Cheers," Cousins said. Roseland residents take pride in Obama's work there and say they've seen signs of a turnaround. Chicago officials recently launched a $750 million program to improve neglected neighborhoods, including Roseland, and have detailed plans for a train line extension. The Greater Roseland Chamber of Commerce hopes a community hospital will grow into a medical district. Judy Ware is preparing to resume table service at the ranch after struggling through the coronavirus pandemic. A fire set during unrest following George Floyd's killing in Minneapolis destroyed the restaurant's interior, and takeout only couldn't sustain the business, which has been operating for more than 50 years. After renaming it Ware Ranch Steakhouse and installing new flooring and orange booths, Ware is feeling optimistic as she prepares to reopen this month. "If we can weather the storm, I think we'll come out good on the other side," she said. "There is a lot of stuff waiting to happen in Roseland." Years of plans can't spare angst over closing schools, by Yesenia Robles of Chalkbeat, Colorado. With students leaving one side of Aurora and new students showing up on the opposite end of the city, the Aurora School District needed a new plan to rearrange classroom space. It started collecting public opinion and crafting a long-term plan 5 years ago. Yet now many parents are upset and school board members are split over the next key step, to close two elementary schools. At a chaotic board meeting that stretched almost until midnight last month, board members grilled the administration about its plans, proposed closing different schools, and called it unfair that they may be asked to provide alternative guidance if they rejected the superintendent's proposal. In the end, they delayed a vote and decided to take up the closure proposal later this month. "There's no painless way to close a school," experts and educators say, "no matter how much work and time a district puts in. The goal," researchers say, "is to allow communities to feel empowered in crafting solutions and to feel their voice was heard." Although Aurora tried to do that, some parents feel they weren't consulted early enough nor informed about potential school closures. In reorganizing campuses, Aurora school officials said they can't keep all schools open and still provide broad and high-quality academics and enriching programs everywhere. "Small schools are a legitimate approach, but you have to design the entire system then to support that," Superintendent Rico Munn said. "It's a dramatic philosophical switch. Right now, running small schools prevents the district from investing in other programming. If we keep investing in half-empty buildings, we're not investing in resources and people," Munn said. But the school board, which includes three members who joined in November, well after the district drafted the facilities plan, known as Blueprint APS, may not agree. Many metro area districts are losing enrollment and anticipate closing small schools. In Jeffco, which closed one school last year and may close another without any long-term closure process, board members suggested looking at schools as a part of their neighborhoods, as Aurora did, rather than just closing any school that hits low enrollment. Denver is also considering a regional approach, but Aurora's experience shows that long-range planning doesn't necessarily make the process easier. Aurora is losing the most enrollment in the low-income West near Denver and gaining it in new middle-income subdivisions near the plains. This year, school year, an advisory committee in Munn recommended closing two small Northwest elementary schools, Sable and Paris, at the end of next school year. Last year, the district also closed several other schools, and the administration is likely to recommend more closures in coming years. As often happens elsewhere, the school closures in Aurora hit a low-income immigrant community the hardest. It's a blunt instrument, and unfortunately, those communities aren't left with good choices, said Sally Nuema of Northwestern University. They know when those schools are taken, they won't be provided with other strong public resources, so they feel they have to protect the public resources they have. When a school district seeks public input before closing schools, it should make the community feel empowered, she said. That means involving people before proposing a solution, said Nuema, an assistant professor of human development and social policy. Munn said Aurora sought to do that through focus groups, surveys, regional design groups, and more over the past several years. We really were trying to be thoughtful. We tried to really let the community tell us its vision for that future. And now we're at what is the difficult part, Munn said. I think where people get caught off guard is when it becomes real. Aurora may have downplayed the implications of the plan. Early on, the district focused on soliciting community desires for its schools and mentioned repurposing campuses rather than closing them. Just before spring break, Sable parents learned their school might close. They said they don't understand why it was chosen. I feel they haven't been honest, said parent Brenda Pineda, who said she didn't hear about Blueprint until this year. I wish they would have explained everything from the beginning instead of hearing different reasons at each meeting. It leads us to think there has to be something else going on. Pineda, a mother of a third grader at Sable, said the district said that it's about enrollment, but she hasn't noticed few children at her school. Then she heard it was about how that affected the budget, but she's heard that schools got an influx of money for pandemic relief. Now she's heard that the building location is attractive for other uses. Sable, with 370 students, and Paris, with 250, aren't the two smallest schools in their area, where each school had enrollment declines from 26% to 45%. Munn said that because low enrollment affects most district schools, it doesn't itself trigger a closure. Instead, Munn's approach considers neighborhood regions as a whole and also looks at building conditions, capacity of nearby schools, and whether the campus could be used for other purposes, among other factors. On March 22nd, the board could choose to keep Sable and Paris open. If it does, Munn asked members to be prepared to give him guidance on alternatives, such as new rules for picking schools to close or asking him to maintain small schools. We would need clarity around what that direction is because the problems are still there. They still exist, Munn said. Apart from being a facility's plan to close schools in under-enrolled neighborhoods and to plan for new schools in new developments, Blueprint was also designed to incorporate educational changes. The district is opening magnet schools with different themes in each of its seven regions, including an arts magnet opening in the fall and remodeling to create more K-8 programs. Munn said he has prioritized equity. He told the board the investments amount to about $90 million for schools on the east side and $87 million for those on the west side. The long-term plans will serve Aurora well as demographics continue to shift, said Parker Baxter of the University of Colorado Denver. This is where I give Aurora credit for intentionally addressing this over a long-term process because it is going to be difficult, said Baxter, director of the university's Center for Education Policy Analysis. He has evaluated the community engagement element of the district's blueprint plan. But big-picture equity doesn't necessarily translate to satisfaction among families who might lose a neighborhood school. Lucero Gonzalez doesn't want her third-grade daughter, Valentina, 9, to face more years of change. She wants us to save her school, and I want her to feel our love and support in her heart so she knows we tried everything we could, Gonzalez said. If the board approves the district's plans to close Sable. Valentina and her third grade classmates would finish the fourth grade there, but transfer to a new school for fifth grade and then to another for middle school. That's after the pandemic has already interrupted their elementary learning since first grade. That's a lot of change for kids, Gonzalez said. For Gonzalez herself, Sable has become family. Through a program, she learned some English, and now she is working on her GED. She has made friends with other immigrant mothers who, like her, have no family here and depend on other moms for social interaction. With different native languages, they communicate in the English they learned at Sable. The district's long-range facility advisory committee initially considered closing Park Lane Elementary, but then recommended closing Sable and looking at other uses for the space because of its large parking lot and location. They also worried that if Park Lane closed, Sable could not accommodate the displaced students. That late shift in plans meant that parents from Sable didn't find out about a possible closure of their school until after the committee issued its recommendations. On the district's earlier notice, Sable wasn't on the initial list of possible closures. Now families doubt that their community will benefit from the proceeds or from the new use of the building. Gonzalez fears that if her school closes, the community of moms will be split up. Many don't have cars and can't walk to a school elsewhere. Friends are the family we choose, Gonzalez said. It's very sad to think we won't see the people we share our lives with again. 57 years and 11,000 students. Retiring Sandy Doe was one of MSU's first faculty members, by Bruce Finley. During her 57 years of teaching roughly 11,000 students, retiring Metropolitan State University of Denver English professor Sandy Doe, 81, rolled with changes in public higher education and how it is done. Now, as she and an older generation of tenured veterans around the nation start to step out, challenges are multiplying over finance, affordability, freedom of speech, even the purpose of education in relation to jobs. And she shared her perspectives in an interview for Navigating an Uncertain Future. She advocates an emphasis on producing well-rounded thinkers. Is the sky falling? No, she said, but it might. Her career began in the freewheeling days around 1965. She was one of the first teachers when what became MSU Denver emerged as an opportunity school devoted to the mission of giving people from all walks a chance at a college education. Back then, students dodged traffic, racing to classes scattered in rented downtown basements and diners. The classes then were more interactive, sometimes extended over beers, with an age and ideologically diverse mix of students, including Vietnam War veterans, Doe said. She wasn't much older than her students. There was a World War II veteran who turned in an essay about how he survived the Bataan Death March. Today, MSU Denver's mission remains the same. More than 20,000 students enrolled this year on a campus that opened in 1976. It was built as urban renewal, displacing the mostly Hispanic low-income Auraria neighborhood. Doe regards this as a cultural genocide and has deployed writing students to investigate. The school has evolved into what she and other faculty members describe as corporate administrators devoted to marketing, formal rubrics for grading, and students who often seem distanced and brittle. Now it is very hard to pull responses out of people, she said. Norms of correctness lead to self-censorship. These days, we worry about saying the right thing, and because we worry, we don't say much. A beer with students would be unseemly. She adapted through the COVID-19 pandemic to a Zoom era where connectivity invariably hiccups, and we have to make rules that you have to have your camera on, and at least your face and eyes have to be present, even if your mind is not. Now curriculums increasingly are designed to meet company workforce needs. MSU Denver is pioneering this approach, routing students into engineering, cybersecurity, and health programs that incorporate apprenticeship pathways to jobs. This past week, Amazon announced a partnership in which the company will finance training for workers. We in the humanities have never been training anybody for the workforce, except that we make people flexible and able to think critically, Doe said. Yet she has embraced the idea of higher education as workforce training as long as this means broad studies encouraging independent thinking. You need humanity, compassion, the ability to communicate, to do the task and to ask questions if you have questions, she said. In workforce training, you may learn to fly an airplane. That's job training. But you also have to be able to know that Antoine de Saint-Exupéry wrote Wind, Sand, and Stars, and that Tom Wolfe portrayed a pilot in The Right Stuff. The Amazon partnership presents an interesting opportunity, she said, suggesting a literary dimension drawing on writers such as Sinclair Lewis, who chronicled workplace suffering. It is curious that Amazon should want an educated workforce. Every time I go for jury selection, they don't seem to want an educated juror. Doe plans to retire in May after completing her current course on creative nonfiction writing. Former students remember her fondly. Among them, novelist and short story writer Callie Fiarjo Anstein won an American Book Award. Doe inspired me to be a better human, said Christina Engel, 50, who took her writing courses in the 1990s and became an MSU Denver English senior lecturer teaching medieval and early modern British literature. She teaches from her soul, sometimes giving a student approaching her in the classroom a tiny bow of respect, English department colleague Micheline Olmsted said. Doe treated literature, writing, dance, and drama as essential skills for life, especially important now, she said, in the midst of a great resignation where workers quit jobs they find meaningless. I don't see any point in going for the money if you are not happy, if you don't feel satisfied, if you don't feel you are making a contribution for the betterment of people and the world. She prioritized robust discussion. Her courses carried students as far as the Niobrara River in canoes for literature and landscape of the Nebraska sandhills. In teaching modern poetry, Doe entered her classroom wearing a black cape and tricorn hat to take on the persona of legendary poet Marianne Moore, talking about creating imaginary gardens with real toads in them. Last week, during the midterm readings portion of her creative nonfiction course, she encouraged a student who had worked in Ukraine conducting forest research to share messages she was receiving from friends in Ukraine who were struggling to survive Russia's attacks, hiding in a basement without food and water, their town destroyed, after neighbors who ran for safety were shot. That spurred discussion that continued after class. Her joy has been meeting people and seeing students attempt and achieve. Her regret has been the in-house wrangling of academia over who will teach courses and run the department. Teaching, she says, is about reaching and changing each individual learner. She sees relatively affordable public schools like MSU Denver as crucial for addressing a societal slide toward hatred and inability to tell true from false. My concern for higher education, heading into an uncertain future, is to preserve freedom of speech, to preserve the art of debate as intelligent argument, to nurture informed and skilled expression, Doe said. Now she'll focus on her own writing. She's published several books of poetry. I don't know what I'll do without students. And she's planning a fiery burn party to destroy all the grade sheets she saved. Two candidates for Congress qualify for primary ballot. Two congressional candidates, one a Democrat and the other a Republican, have each submitted enough required signatures to appear on the June 28th state primary ballot, according to the Colorado Secretary of State's office. Alex Walker is a Democratic candidate for U.S. House of Representatives District 3, and Jan Coleman is a Republican candidate for U.S. House of Representatives District 8. Congressional candidates are required to collect 1,500 signatures or 10% of votes cast in the last election, whichever is smaller, in their district, according to the Secretary of State's office. Coleman submitted 2,063 valid signatures, while Walker submitted 1,713, each meeting the required threshold, according to a Friday news release. Walker, a political newcomer, is running to unseat Republican U.S. Representative Lauren Boebert of Silt. Coleman, who is the mayor of Thornton, as well as an engineer in oil and gas, is running for Colorado's newly created 8th Congressional District. And hikers find human remains in Jeffco Canyon. A pair of hikers stumbled on human remains in a remote location in Clear Creek Canyon on Saturday afternoon, according to the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office. The remains were discovered Saturday in the area of Tunnel 2 on U.S. 6, which is west of Golden but east of the intersection with Colorado 119. The Sheriff's Office said in a statement that the death did not happen recently. The remains were retrieved around 1 p.m. Sunday. The highway was closed in the area while crews cleared the scene. Deputies were asked motorists to take it slow through that location. Sheriff's spokeswoman Jenny Fulton said the death appeared to have happened at least months and perhaps years ago. "We don't know the circumstances," she said. "We're not treating it as a homicide at this point. It could be an accidental death, a suicide, a medical issue." In sports, CSU's drought over. For first time since 2013, Rams get a berth by Sean Keeler. For the first time in almost a decade, CSU's Rams are putting their NCAA tournament dancing on shoes again and dancing with one of the blue bloods of college basketball. Their first port of call, Indianapolis, as a number 6 seed in the South region on Thursday against the 11th seeded Michigan Wolverines. "Listen, you get to this time of the year, all the teams that are in this tourney, they're there for a reason," Coach Nico Medved said after the field was announced during a watch party at Canvas Stadium. "So this is the best of the best this year in college basketball, and so whoever you're going to play is going to be really good. And you know, I haven't watched a ton of Michigan, but I've watched them play. They're obviously incredibly talented. They're well coached in one of the best leagues in the country. But that's what you want. That's what you get this time of the year. You want to be out there. You're going to play somebody like that." It's the first NCAA tourney bid for the Rams since March 2013 and the first under Medved, who also agreed to an amended contract that will keep him in Fort Collins through 2029, the university announced just before the selection show. CSU's 6th seed is the best in program history, besting the slot on the 8 line received by the Rams in the 13 big dance. The Wolverines are led by 7'1" center Hunter Dickinson, who averaged 18.3 points and 8.3 rebounds per game, one of 6 Michigan players who are 6'8" or taller. They're long, athletic, kind of the high major prototype build CSU forward, David Roddy said. "A bunch of these guys have been working hard in the weight room ever since we got here 2 to 3 years now. I think we'll be okay." As part of Medved's new deal, the fourth-year coach is slated to make $1.1 million annually in base compensation through June 30, 2024. That jumps to $1.15 million in the 24-25 fiscal year, then $1.2 million in 25-26, $1.25 million in 26-27, $1.3 million potentially in 27-28 and 28-29, if the additional years are exercised by either party. The total base compensation is $9.5 million from April 1, 2022 through June 30, 2029. Medved or a future employer would need to pay 33% of the remaining base pay to buy out the contract. If Medved were let go without cause, CSU would owe 100% of the remaining base salary, subject to being offset by future employment. Thankfully, for CSU faithful, Selection Sunday was one that came and went without the heartbreak and disappointment of recent years. The Rams were listed as one of the last 4 out, as revealed by the NCAA Tournament's selection committee in both 2015 under then-coach Larry Ustachi and in 2021 under Medved. That was their goal the whole year. They were not going to let that happen again, Medved said. It's like a dream come true. The program had no drama this March thanks to an excellent regular season marked by non-conference wins over St. Mary's, Creighton, and Mississippi State, and a conference sweep of Boise State. And CSU sends message, "Hands off Medved," by Sean Keeler. "Missouri needs a basketball coach. So does Louisville and Maryland and LSU and Kansas State. Not a shallow pocket in the bunch." Miko Medved's players were wondering about that, too. It was the elephant lingering in the back of the fourth-floor suites at Canvas Stadium, crammed between the cocktail bar and the buffet. Your guys can only turn off Twitter for so long, especially when it's Selection Sunday and your coach just led CSU to its first NCAA tournament bid in nearly a decade. He told us about the extension a little bit before we came down, senior guard Kendall Moore told me during the Rams' Bracketville party at Canvas. Coach was like, "Hey, I got an extension, but it's not about me, it's about you guys." Sunday really was about him, though. All of it. The succeed, the big dance, the CBS television cameras, Indianapolis, a date with Michigan, the new contract. Medved, CSU's men's basketball coach, walked into a pile of straw 4 years ago, charred and splintered by years of Larry Stacey, and spun it into gold. "I can't control the narrative," Medved laughed after the Rams announced, just before the opening strains of the Selection Show's theme song, that he'd signed a contract extension with raises that could run through the summer of 2029. "We love what we're doing, what we're building here. I think we've got a lot of work for us here, and so that's what that's about. Regardless of whatever manic, mad fun plays out over the next 7 days or 3 weeks or however long this magic carpet ride lasts, the core of a 25-5 Rams team could return largely intact next fall." Mountain West Player of the Year David Roddy is a junior, so is star point guard Isaiah Stevens. Who could walk away from these kids, or these fans proud to the last, or this much joy, or the ecstatic hollers that bounced off the walls of the fourth floor suites when CSU's name got called? A glorious "Hey!" rang out from the roughly 150 assembled when Michigan's name came up next. A mighty "Ooh!" followed. "I think this is definitely just the beginning," Roddy said, "of the Rams' future. The sky's the limit for this team and this program. Coach's legacy is to have CSU be a mid-major powerhouse, maybe even a high major. We've got a really high major resources." Medved can now walk into living rooms and recruit fresh off an NCAA berth with a 7-year extension in his back pocket. Athletic Director Joe Parker said that conversations on the new deal probably started 4 or 5 weeks ago, with the administration's goal to bring them closer to the top 2 or 3 within the conference. Parker's missteps have been well documented, but the men's hoops program of late hasn't suffered from many. CSU was smart to plant a flag before the rumor mill gets cranking. It's coach poaching season, and Nico is part of the furniture now, for as long as he wants to be. It's that last part that you wonder about. FOCO is a fabulous place to live, the picture on the postcard that's the envy of your loved ones. But keep this in mind, too. Medved's buyout, if initiated by the coach or by another poaching school, calls for 33% of his remaining base salary. After June 30th, that remaining base adds up to $8.4 million, assuming the two final option years are picked up. A third of $8.4 million is $2.79. Perspective: LSU's men's basketball operating expenses in 2019-20 pre-pandemic totaled $9.26 million. The Tigers paid out $4.1 million in coaches' salaries and bonuses in 19-20, according to NCAA reports. If someone wants Medved badly enough, they'll pay. "It's definitely the beginning at CSU for sure," Moore said. "Hopefully we just make more and more tournament appearances. Hopefully." The elephant isn't dead, but it's a heck of a lot smaller than a week ago. For Medved, the money might be greener on the other side. After Sunday, the grass sure as heck isn't. McKinnon nets pair in victory by Mike Chambers. Center Nathan McKinnon scored twice, and goalie Darcy Kemper produced a 46-save shutout as the Avalanche climbed out of a rare rut on Sunday at Ball Arena. The Avs entered the Western Conference showdown against the Calgary Flames a salty 1-3-1 in their last 5 games, but McKinnon gave them enough offense, and Kemper was exceptional in a 3-0 victory over the second-best team in the conference. "It was a big win for us," said Kemper, who was pulled after allowing 3 goals early in his last meeting against Calgary. "Definitely a different outcome for sure. Winning is a lot more fun." McKinnon scored a power play goal midway through the period and got his 21st of the season early in the third for a 2-0 lead. Winger Mikko Rantanen added an empty netter in the waning minutes. "It's fun to play when your goalie is making those saves," Rantanen said of Kemper. "He gives us confidence." Colorado, which was blanked 2-0 on Thursday at the Carolina Hurricanes, to cap a 1-2 road trip, entered Sunday in the midst of its worst five-game stretch of the season since beginning 2-3-0 in October. Calgary was part of that problem. The Pacific Division leading Flames defeated the Central leading Avalanche 4-3 in overtime on March 5th at Ball Arena. Kemper was pulled from that game, and backup Pavel Francouz allowed the goal in OT. The teams conclude their three-game series in March 29 in Calgary. The Flames, who played at home on Saturday night, produced 22 shots in the third period. Colorado took all three penalties in the frame, including a delay of game minor by forward Logan O'Connor that led the Calgary's 6-4 on attack. Third period, when they were on their push, they got some really good chances. Even at the end of the game, 6-on-4, Avs coach Jared Bednar said, "Kemper made some big saves for us, so I like his game a lot. He was sharp from start to finish." The Avs were missing left wing and team captain Gabe Landeskog and second-pairing defenseman Sam Girard to injuries. Landeskog is scheduled to undergo knee surgery on Monday. Girard is out approximately 4 weeks with a lower body injury. "When you lose your captain, other guys have to step up and be vocal in the locker room," Rantanen said. "Sometimes we can get a little bit quiet during the games on the bench, and I think we need to try to work to be better than that." Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Dee Hyslop.